Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic classroom lectures in business and economics recorded for podcast. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2010. Lecture 4, delivered on January 21, 2010. The title of this lecture is Financial Institutions and the Federal Reserve System.
Today, Financial Institutions and the Federal Reserve System. You might have heard some of this story before. The light end of it is going to be the financial institutions. And I'm going to do more or less a relatively cursory pass over financial institutions in general. Then I will get down to the nitty-gritty of the Federal Reserve System, which has such huge importance in our economy that I cannot ignore it in a first-pass finance class. Economics, macroeconomics classes should teach you about the Federal Reserve System in detail, but generally I'm finding that they are wanting in some regards. Now, here's a couple of things. First of all, on my education website, isu-prof.com, this weekend I'll put up a stupid, lame-ass video that is done by the Federal Reserve. It's a cartoon video of how the Federal Reserve System works. It's stupid, but it actually covers the basics in about what I'm going to do here, except I hit one important aspect of the Federal Reserve in much more detail than that video does. Also, this video, obviously produced by the Federal Reserve, is not going to tell you some of the bad things and some of the issues that have shown their ugly heads at the Federal Reserve. However, the video isn't too long. It's a flash video. It lasts maybe about 15, 20 minutes. It does cover some of the basics and things that I might throw out as a quick question on an exam or a quiz. So it's worth you watching that as well as watching what I'm doing here. Let me make an interesting point about this textbook. It was written before the financial crisis. Now, the financial crisis revealed gaping holes in our regulatory system. The idea that this revealed the evils of capitalism, the failings of the banks, that's not what was revealed. The big thing that was revealed by the financial crisis, as far as our regulatory system goes, is first of all that our regulatory system of the financial institutions is something of a hodgepodge. It has been for a long time, just sort of accumulating one regulatory agency that watches this part, another regulatory agency that watches this part. That's one of the problems, is there's a hodgepodge of regulation. There's not a comprehensive regulator. The second thing it revealed was the fact that there is between government and the regulators and the regulated an incestuous relationship. There always has been, and it does not apply just to financial regulation. Primarily, one of the greatest problems, of course, is in the military, the revolving door between the military at its top brass level and the private industry, the military contractors. These kinds of incestuous relationships tend to dampen the zeal of the regulators for doing their jobs. And I don't want to say we should over-regulate, but when we talk about reforming the financial system, and they've talked a lot about it, but they haven't done much about it, I'm going to give you some pointers on that. First of all, it hasn't been done. It's been talked about. Second of all, the failed people in the government are still there, for the most part. Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary under the Bush administration, is of course gone because it's a new administration. However, Ben Bernanke is still the Federal Reserve chairman, and jaw-droppingly, President Obama has nominated him for a second term, even though the man demonstrably, catastrophically failed in his job. Second, the Federal Reserve Bank President of New York, Timothy Geithner, who was at the epicenter of the failed bank system. He was appointed by President Obama as the Secretary of the Treasury. That's just jaw-dropping that we do not have this system where we maybe not throw them in prison and kick them into prison and throw away the key, but we certainly should not be rewarding malfeasance like that. Although we're all ready to go and kick the ass of the banks and the bank presidents and all of the executives at the banks, we're not ready to do the same thing in a public and very spectacular way to the failed regulators. So I predicate my remarks about our Federal Reserve System by pointing out that there are deep flaws, and they still exist. And I'm going to assign you a couple of articles to read this weekend that I wrote, The Federal Reserve Under Fire, Part 1, and The Federal Reserve Under Fire, Part 2. I'll also give you an optional reading called The Gospel of Impending Doom. I wrote about the financial crisis that was coming before it happened. And in that time, guess who listened to me? No one but the sad people who listen to who read my damn articles. Now we have this situation. Well, no one could possibly have imagined. Oh, like hell. It wasn't that hard to see. But I'm going to have you read some articles in which you will see how you think in order to see what's about to happen. There's an old saying. Well, let me try this. In your judgment, what's the best way to predict the future?
You can't.
Oh, don't do that. We can. Even if we can't, we can pretend we can and charge people money.
Look at the history.
Okay, that's what most people say. In order to predict, the best way to predict the future is to look at history. In fact, that's not how you predict the future. I'm going to tell you a secret now, okay? The best way to predict the future is to create it. You remember that. Now, let's get down to business here. Financial intermediation is the flow of funds between surplus economic units and deficit economic units. Funds flow from the surplus units to the deficit units, and then as the deficit units repay those obligations, the funds flow back from the deficit units to the surplus units. That's financial intermediation in a nutshell. The book gives it almost this impression that it's a one-way street from the surplus units to the deficit units. No, it's a flow. It's happening all the time. It is the hustle of life in business, is the movement of money back and forth between those who need it and those who have it. In the world of finance, we have institutions that facilitate this process. It would be difficult for me to find someone in here who would be able to lend me some money. So I go to a financial institution, a specialization agent in that kind of deal. And that is why banks, finance companies, and other financial institutions exist. There is a need for a matching of need and supply. It's not quite that easy, though. You see, because the facilitation is not just a unidimensional thing. You have $20 in your pocket.
No, I do not.
Oh, concentrate. Let's pretend you actually have some money so that you can don't have to borrow off your friends to eat tonight. Do you have enough money to eat tonight? Dude, you need to eat, okay? You're thin. Yeah, you get some fat on those bones, you know. Yeah. You see, if he had $20 in his pocket, I need $1,000. There's nothing he and I can do to work together on this. So one of the first facilitations that an intermediary, a financial institution, can do is match fund need with fund supply. So there's the matching of denominations is the first. Match denominations. That's what they can do first. There are people who need, like, if I needed $100, I would not go to a commercial bank that does loans in the millions of dollars. They'd look at me, why are you here? Because you got money. Well, we don't lend money to little things, little people like you, even to little businesses. So the intermediation, the facilitation in its first dimension is denomination matching. Now, the second aspect of the facilitation is maturity matching. There are some people who could let go of $100,000 for a year. Now, they cannot be matched with a company that needs that much money for 5 years. So there has, as a second aspect of facilitation in intermediation, in financial institutions, we have maturity matching. We match the ability of the lenders with the suppliers of the funds with the needs in terms of duration of those who have it. Like, for example, have you ever seen those quick cash places, borrow money today and pay it back with your next paycheck? Biggest ripoffs God ever made. But that's how a free market works. Now, I cannot go to that place if I need a loan for a new car. That would not be a place where I could do it because that'd probably be a 4 or 5 year loan. These places are for what? A week, 2 weeks, 30 days, that kind of thing. So that would not be, there would not be that matching of maturities there. So the facilitation process gets the right people, the right suppliers of money with those who need it for that length of time. So maturity matching is the next part of it. Now here's one that your textbook actually kind of beats around, and they don't actually hit it on the head. It's risk matching. Risk matching. Just plain risk matching. You see, you look like a very conservative young man. You look like you're the kind who might lend money, but you're not going to lend money for a high roller, for a really risky adventure, okay? So you wouldn't want to be put in touch with high-risk projects. There are surplus economic units who would do that, because there's a possibility of a much better return on that kind. But you don't want that. You'd rather take a lower risk profile and therefore have a lower expected return. So you wouldn't be a good match for, say, me if I were to do some kind of very risky business venture. In the same regard, I'm going to tell you something really horrible here. Someday you're going to be old, you're going to be wrinkled, you're going to be sad and alone. And every month, at the end of the month, you are going to rush to your mailbox because you know you're going to have that retirement check there. And then you can hire a boy toy for a night and maybe for the next day. Yeah, but you see, when you're putting money away for retirement, you don't want that money to go into some very high-risk thing where you could, might make a big amount of money, but you could also have no money for retirement. So in that regard, you see that same thing. You would want the money that you put into a financial institution to be invested in safe things, so that you were pretty sure that money was going to be there when you retired. Okay, so you can have this friend. You're looking like, God, I want out of this class. Okay, so literally just pure credit matching. Risk matching is part of the financial intermediator's facilitation services. And there are other aspects too, minor aspects, but the three that are important are denomination matching, maturity matching, and risk matching.
Excuse me.
And I'm trying to think. Okay. One other thing that the I left out one that is important too is that the book does go through is credit risk absorption. Credit risk absorption. This is actually a little more complicated than how the book presents it, because, and we'll get to this in a lot more detail later, but a financial institution, a large institution, can gather a portfolio of loans as its assets. Now, each loan has its own risk of failure. However, when you collect those assets together, there is this effect, and we'll see talk about this a lot when I get to portfolio control theory, is that when you lump a lot of volatile things together, there's still volatility, but there's a part of the volatility that goes away. And what happens is if you get enough assets together that each has its own possible volatility, they cancel part of each other's volatility out so that what remains of volatility is like a hum, this non-diversifiable risk, as we call it. So in an important sense, when a financial institution deals in lots of loans, it has this ability to suppress part of the volatility that would otherwise be experienced by an individual lending money just to another person. If I lend money as a lender to a million different borrowers, something happens to the risk that is being acquired in this process. If I am just a person making a loan, I'm exposed to all kinds of risk. But if I've lent a lot of different loans, at least a little bit of that risk settles out. Some of the volatility cancels each other out. Now, there's another part of credit absorption, credit risk absorption. And I think the book meant more this. Well, no, I don't know. I shouldn't say that. Here it is. Look, a financial institution specializes in moving money between surplus and deficit economic units. So as a specialist in this, they have specialized knowledge, specialized access to ways to determine risk. Now, I'm looking at you. Oh, you're a handsome, upstanding young Presbyterian stud. Sure, I'll lend you money. I don't know how to assess your risk properly. I don't have the access to all of the credit reporting agencies. I don't have access to the data to analyze your income to know what that means about your probability of default and all of that. But a financial institution does have access to all of that. So if surplus economic units want to lend to deficit economic units, the intermediary, a financial institution, would be in a much better position to decide for me as a surplus unit whether or not you qualify for my money. Okay? So that's there's that little aspect in there that's hugely important, is that a bank can tell more about you than I can. So I would rather put my money into a bank and have it lend it to you than for me to lend directly to you, even though we could both probably do better if we did it ourselves. My risk is lowered as a surplus unit by having the bank assess you on my behalf, because they can just do it better than I can. And if I were to spend the money to do it the right way, I'd lose any advantage anyway to lending it to you directly. So it's a little bit different from how your textbook presents it, but I don't want to trash the textbook. It's doing just fine, but I want you to know that there's a little more depth to it than how it was presented there. Now, this is almost like a duh. Commercial banks, how do they make their money? Well, they make their money off the spread between what they pay the surplus units to keep their money and what they charge the deficit units to borrow that money. So the spread, interest rate spread, is the lever. That's the incentive to be a banker. That's the incentive right there to be a banker, is the spread that I can get on the interest rate. Okay, you deposit money in an account. I'll pay you 3%. Okay, I'll pay you 2%. Okay, you borrow money from me, I'm going to charge you 8%. That spread there is my money. That's where I make my money. I don't make my money at the horse races. I don't make my money selling cheeseburgers. I make my money by spreading the interest. The farther the spread, the better. But I can't just spread it as far as I want, because obviously I have competitors out there. I have a competitor who would say, well, I will pay you 4%. I have a competitor out here there who says, I will lend you money at 7%. So the market has a discipline that keeps me from screwing you as the surplus unit and screwing you as the deficit unit. So there has to be a robust competition, though. That's important to this process. If I don't have competing banks out there, I can screw you and I can screw you. Okay? So that's the importance, again, of competition to a healthy financial system. It keeps the financial intermediaries from taking advantage of the surplus and the deficit economic units. If that competition is not there, if it is diminished by virtue of antitrust activities, by virtue of large financial institutions controlling the financial environment, then all bets are off. So let me make it clear here. Competition is good for all of us. It keeps me as a financial intermediary tight. I don't waste money because I can't screw anybody. And it also keeps the surplus and the deficit units from overpaying or losing money in the process. It keeps me lean as a bank if I have competitors who keep me from going overboard with my practices. Regulation. The big 800-pound gorilla, regulation. And there is flux in this, more talk than action. There are regulators of banks and other financial institutions. And I can name you the regulators, and I can tell you which financial institutions each regulates. First things first. Banks are chartered. Some banks are chartered at the state level. Some banks are chartered at the federal level. Now, regulation of banks. There are state regulators of banks and there are federal regulators of banks. Interestingly, the regulatory environment is a hodgepodge. Let's go through, and I'm just going to list some regulators here. There is the Federal Reserve. That is one place, that is one institution that could regulate banks. Now, there is also the Comptroller of the Currency, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. That is a part of the Treasury Department. Comptroller of the currency. That is part of the Treasury Department, the U.S. Treasury Department. That's a comptroller of the currency. There is the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. That is another regulator that could be a regulator of a given bank. And then there are state regulators. Each of these has responsibility for one type of bank. Now, right there, you can see that this is not a very cool situation, because we're talking about, and I haven't even gone into credit unions, which have their own regulatory structure. And insurance companies, which can actually provide certain kinds of lending services by creating banks or pseudo-banks. And then there are other kinds of banks. It's a hodgepodge, and it has been building as a hodgepodge for literally decades and decades. It's sort of like, it's sort of stacked, and there was never a comprehensive understanding. And it got worse because after when the Great Depression hit, let me go back to the late 1800s. In the early part of the country's history, the banking system was just a wild west, literally a wild west. And there were all kinds of disasters, one after the other. One bank, a big bank, would just fail, and that would scare people. They would rush their own banks, and then those banks would collapse, even though they were okay. When people charged the bank for their funds, raced into the bank, the banks just fell apart. You'd have these waves of bank failures. It was just a disastrous system. And then, so in the second decade of the 20th century, Congress said, enough of this. And they passed the Federal Reserve Act. And that essentially put the Federal Reserve system into place and put a regulatory structure on the banking system. Now, still, problems developed. And there was a catastrophic financial crisis in 1929. Part of it was just a failure of the regulatory structure, especially a failure of the regulatory structure to control some of the very powerful banking interests, the Rothschild family, which actually induced part of the crisis by deliberately, to a certain extent, just to enrich themselves. And so in the 1930s, when this really tough and admittedly liberal Congress and president got their hands on the whole matter, they said, enough of this. We're going to put into place a set of laws that really crack down on the banking system, put them under a fist. And so eventually we had what was called the Glass-Steagall Act. The Glass-Steagall Act. This did all kinds of different things. For one thing, it set up a wall between insurance and banking, banking and stock and brokering. It was just walls all over the place. You do one thing, don't play in other markets. You do this and nothing else. And if you do it wrong, we're going to crack your ass. That was Glass-Steagall. Well, the banks just screamed and cried, and finally by the 1990s, towards the end of the 1990s, Glass-Steagall began to come apart. And it was essentially just eliminated. And so the banks just went wild again, and that was one of the things that caused the financial crisis. There is very little talk about bringing back a more, we'd have to have a new version. We couldn't just bring back Glass-Steagall. We'd have to have a modernized version of it. No one's talking about that. Partly because, of course, the people in Congress, they get a lot of their campaign funds from the banks and the financial institutions. But the Glass-Steagall Act not existing is a major issue because that took away some of the laws that the regulators could use to crack down on the banks and their banking practices. Now, let me get back to this just for a minute here. The system is just kind of almost the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. This place right here in the Treasury Department, this place regulates the federally chartered banks. Now, it was a lot of these federally chartered banks were some of the heavy-duty industrial strength banks that came apart at the seams in the crisis last year. Last year and 2 years ago. And the crisis is still going on, by the way. Bank closures are happening at a staggering rate. It was our Treasury Department, which is right in the center of the government, a cabinet-level position, that was responsible for federally chartered banks, regulating them. It apparently didn't do its job very well. So that's there. Now, the Federal Reserve, surprisingly, its job is to manage to regulate the state chartered banks. That are members of the Federal Reserve System. I'll get to that in a little bit. That are members of the Federal Reserve System. Okay, well, where do the state regulators fit in? The FDIC, which provides the insurance and provides insurance up to $100,000 for deposits, the FDIC regulates state banks that are not members of the Federal Reserve System. That are non-members of the Federal Reserve System. Now, this is great bait for some questions, multiple choice questions on exams and all that. But really, more my point here is to give you an idea of just what a hodgepodge this is. And you hear talking heads on TV talk about, well, we've got to have better regulation and all that. This is the detail. You're seeing the internal guts of why the system has the mess that it does. Now, the state regulators primarily oversee state banks that are not part of the FDIC. That don't participate in the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. And let's try something here. Let me try something, just to try to drive this point home for you. Madam, which regulator regulates your bank? You have a bank, right?
Sure.
Which one of them regulates your bank? Can't say right off the top of your head, can you?
No.
See, that's okay. That's okay. You see, this is the problem with it, though, is you don't know who regulates your bank. Who do you call? Ghostbusters? Yeah, the Federal Reserve? Do you call the Fed? Do you call Comptroller of the Currency? Do you call the FDIC? Do you call the state? Where do you look for your bank's regulator? Most people trust their money. It says bank. That means it must be safe. Oh, like hell, you don't even know who's watching it. You leave you put all your money in your house, and then you just leave. Leave the doors unlocked if you wish. Wouldn't it be nice if you knew who was watching that money?
Yeah.
You'll do that if it's in your house, but you don't do that. And it's okay. No, I don't know who regulates my bank. I honestly don't, because I'm not sure what the hell my bank is. But yeah, okay, that's enough of that. I do want to bring up, just really quickly, I mentioned credit unions. Now, credit unions, one point I should make about a credit union is that a credit union, most people think it's a bank, or it's just like a bank. It is not. Now, credit unions have gotten by with murder, and I do agree with bank executives who are screaming about how credit unions have special rules that give them a competitive advantage. No question about that. Credit unions don't pay federal taxes. Credit unions, they have their own regulatory structure and all that kind of stuff. It's a great thing. One thing that I do want to warn you about is that if you put your money into a checking account at a credit union, that's not a checking account like a bank. You see, because a checking account at a bank is, technically speaking, what we call a demand account. The money can be acquired by the bearer of a check from that bank on demand. So you can get your money on demand. Someone who you write a check to can go to that bank and get the money that is claimed on demand. That's how banks work. Credit unions do not have demand deposits. For all intents and purposes, it looks like they do. You can put an ATM card in and get your money out. You can someone can cash your check at a credit union. It'll be honored right away. But technically speaking, it doesn't have to be, because those accounts are not demand deposit accounts. They are negotiable order of withdrawal accounts, which means that there can be a delay. They don't do it hardly ever, but there can be a delay. A bank has to provide you your money right there on the spot, as long as you provide the credentials that they request for it. Enough of that. I do want to bring up, there are other kinds of financial institutions. Of course, savings and loans, they have their own system. Savings and loans went through a huge crisis in the 1980s, before most of you were alive. It was in the late 80s. It was just a real big disaster. And I personally thought savings and loans would just disappear, become sort of like a historical artifact. They actually are still around. And there are variations on the savings and loan. Old time, they used to be called building and loan and all that kind of stuff. But S&Ls are still around. Technically, we call those thrift institutions. Now, there's another kind of bank out there. Now, I've been talking about commercial banks because we'll focus on business lending. But there's another kind of bank out there that's very extremely cool. And you still see some of them on the landscape. And I've worked with several people trying to encourage the government to start fostering this kind of bank to come back big time. They're called mutual banks. Now, a mutual bank, if they accept you as a depositor, you can't just go in there and start an account. That's not how they work. They have to review you, and then they accept your deposit if you pass their qualifications. Because if you become a depositor at that bank, you become an owner of the bank. The bank is owned by the depositors. Literally, it is owned by the people who put their money in that bank. Let me tell you, there is no better way to have a bank watched like a hawk than if the owners are right there putting their money into that bank. Everyone is an owner. So when the bank issues its financial statements, when the bank's president gives himself a raise, they give the bank president a raise, it isn't at an arm's length distance from the shareholders like it is in a normal corporation. Banks are usually corporations. Most of them are. Oh, in a mutual bank, there is an intimate relationship between the owners who are right there, usually in the same community with the executives of the bank. And you know what can happen in a big bank? If a big bank fails, well, the owner of the executives go off and they get their golden parachutes and they go off and write books and do television shows and stuff like that. In a mutual bank, if the bank fails, you know what happens to the executives? They live in the same community. You hunt their asses down and burn their house to the ground and their dog with it. And if their kids are ugly, you spank their kids. See, there's something to be said for not making that distance. Remember how I talked about the wall of separation, how wonderful it is? Bullshit. Sometimes it's great to have the people who caused the disaster right there where you can take a whip and beat them with it. Excuse me for sounding paleo-conservative, but hey, that's me. Okay, now, time to go to the Federal Reserve System. The Federal Reserve System was established by the Federal Reserve Act of 1917. 17, was it? I don't remember. I wasn't around then. It was established to create a regulatory structure to get the banks under control because, as I said, it had been a Wild West environment. And there was, at the time, and even to this day, there is a great deal of bitterness. One conspiracy theory has to do with the Federal Reserve System. The Constitution places the control of the currency, the coining of money, directly under the authority of Congress. The Federal Reserve takes that authority and, in a large measure, sets it off to a system called the Federal Reserve System, which is independent. It is still part of the government. It is still answerable to the government, but it is independent of the government. Now, to give you how serious this is, just recently, there has been talk about actually auditing the Fed, the government auditing the Fed for the first time, I believe, in the history of the Fed. And you think to yourself, what? The Fed has never been audited? The Federal Reserve Bank has the big thing has never been audited? No. Ask, what is the salary of a Federal Reserve Board member? Ask, what are the details of their profits and their losses? Well, we know that they're not supposed to make a profit, so they must be spending any money that would otherwise accrue to a profit line. We don't know. We just don't know. And you ought to hear the Federal Reserve. Ben Bernanke gets up there before Congress. Oh, you can't audit us. That takes away our independence. That shakes the confidence of the financial community in us. He's dead serious, that son of a bitch. He doesn't want to be audited. They'll audit my ass every year on my sad tax form. But that gives you an idea of just how independent this Fed has been. Here's why. We don't want the Congress to be printing money because it would print as much money as it needed for all of its toy programs. If we put the Federal Reserve at a distance from the Congress, then at least the Congress has to use taxes or control spending to get its jobs accomplished. That puts a limit. That's a big, big reason we would like to have the Fed be independent. Unfortunately, the reality of it is that the Fed has been nothing but a printing machine for the government many times. In large parts of modern history, the Fed has printed money whenever the government needed it. And then, unfortunately, the other side of that, the Fed creates inflations doing that, and then the Fed has to crack down. Interestingly, and there is plenty of research to back this up, now I'm not making this claim without backing, the Federal Reserve has a tendency to do its cleanups of its messes right before elections, especially if there is a possibility that a Democrat would be elected. The Fed has most decidedly favored Republican candidates for president. It's just done that. In 2000, Alan Greenspan decided to find Jesus and start clamping down on the money supply in the year 2000. Well, lo and behold, there was going to be an election in the year 2000, a close election. And so we'll clamp down on the money supply, drive the economy towards a recession, and that should make it clear that we need a change of party in the White House. There's no question what he did. We know what he did. And yet he's considered an honored graybeard of financial wisdom now. It's just the reality of it. So the theory of independence is not matched by the practice of independence. Ben Bernanke, right now, he wanted his job again. So what did he do? He has been printing money like there's no tomorrow to fund that economic stimulus package of $787 billion. He was printing money throughout the Bush administration. Now he wants to keep his job, so he's been printing money for the Obama administration. And sure enough, mark my word, we're going to get hit with an inflation, and it's going to be bad. When do you suppose the Federal Reserve is going to start to try to clamp down on that inflation? Well, I'll bet you can predict that. The Federal Reserve System has three primary duties. The first of its duties is as a regulator of banks. Now, the Federal Reserve System is broken into 12 regions. Interestingly, when the regions were established, there were not a lot of people living the farther west you went. So the regions out west are much bigger than the regions towards the east. And that's kind of weird now because the San Francisco Reserve Bank, it's got a huge amount of territory that it has to cover and a lot of banks. And the ones towards the east are actually very small regions, like the New York Bank is just a very tiny region it controls. But it is a regulator of banks. Now, the Federal Reserve System comprises a board of governors. This is seven individuals. And then those individuals are above the reserve banks. Each region has a reserve bank and maybe some branches of the reserve bank in the region. So the board of governors is the top dogs, the big dogs of the banking system, of the Federal Reserve System. Now, historically, the Federal Reserve board members, and the head of them is the chairman. Right now it's Ben Bernanke. Right before him was Alan Greenspan. Now the head, now these board members have historically been the cream of the crop. Just honest, no defects in their records, just very well educated. Just I some years back met two board members, and they just exude that everything about them is just perfect. I don't think they even have sex. I mean, damn, your face, it doesn't move when you talk. Anymore, that's actually kind of eroded. 10 years ago, when I was writing about the board, I would never have found any reason to attack a board member. Now I can just pick off easily three, maybe four of them and just criticize them for their credentials, for their backgrounds, and for their behavior. The last one that was appointed a board governor, she had run a community bank for a while until it fell apart and it was bought by another bank, which asked her to please leave. They gave her a bunch of money, a bunch of stock in Wachovia if she'd leave. Her main job throughout her life before she started that community bank, she was a dinner theater actress. She's now a board governor, for God's sake. Dinner theater actress, my ass. But that aside, the Board of Governors is the seven top dogs, led by a chairman. And then under those governors are the 12 regional reserve banks, the Federal Reserve Banks. And each one of those reserve banks has a president. And those presidents have other duties in the Federal Reserve System aside from watching their own bank. But that was that gentleman I talked about, Timothy Geithner. He was the Reserve Bank president of the New York Bank called the Empire Bank. The Empire Bank is a special bank in the Reserve group of 12, the Reserve Bank, which I'll get to in just a minute here. But now, at the regulator of banks level, in the Federal Reserve's duty as a regulator of banks, the Board of Governors regulates the Reserve Banks supervise. The Board Governors regulate the Reserve Banks supervise. That means that the board writes the rules, and then the Reserve Banks go out and enforce the rules on the banking system in their region. So the board regulates, the Reserve Banks supervise. The board writes the rules, the banks enforce the rules. The Reserve Banks enforce the rules. Okay, so that's its role as a regulator of banks. Now, the second role it has is a bank for banks. It actually competes with private commercial banks that provide the same services. You need a place for a checking account. A bank needs a place for a checking account, too. It doesn't use itself, it uses another bank. And there are banks that provide, one of their big jobs is to provide banking services for banks. Now, the Federal Reserve is one of those places. The Federal Reserve has to compete in the market with commercial banks that do the same thing. The reason that the Federal Reserve is in this system is to foster competition and to push new technologies forward along the way. The Federal Reserve is not allowed to undercharge. In other words, it has to charge the opportunity cost that would be reflected in a private banking system. So it has to behave like a commercial provider, a private commercial provider of banking services for banks. But it's out there, and it is right there in the market. And any bank can choose the Federal Reserve, or it can choose a private commercial service. Now, I want you to appreciate what I just told you there. Banks have a public option. You remember all that pissing about, well, we can't have a public option for insurance because that'd be socialist. We have a public option for banks, and we've had it for decades. A bank can go to the government through the Federal Reserve to get its banking services, or it can go through commercial, private providers of the same service. But all that means is that banks have a public option for their services. And it's an extraordinarily expensive, huge, multi-billions of dollars public option. Hardly anyone knows about that. And it amazes me every time I hear this pissing about a public option. We can't have that for health insurance because that's socialist. We've had it and it actually works. This is one of the places where the Federal Reserve does a really damn good job is providing commercial services because it keeps the noses clean of the big private operations. They can't overcharge because the Fed would undercut them then. And it's brought a lot of fast, new, quick technology, great stuff, so that we can have all these wonderful products that we have like the ATM cards and fast clearing of checks. It is because of all this technology. Have you ever gone to the store and they just swipe your card and just like seconds later they say approved? That's that technology being pushed forward. And the Federal Reserve is largely a part of that, just saying we've got this new technology, we'll share it with the commercial system, the private system, but if you don't use it, you're not going to be able to provide this level of services that we can, so banks are going to come to us instead of you. So this fosters competition, it fosters technological innovation and technology deployment. Okay, now, here's the last part. The big 800-pound political gorilla is the third role of the Federal Reserve, controller of the money supply. And now I'm going to do something. I'm going to make sure that we have this clear in our minds. I'm going to get my breath so it has real foul coffee so that when I lean up and ask someone, the person will want to answer quickly to get my breath out of the way. Madam, what is the cause of inflation?
I don't know.
Wrong answer. You just wanted me to get away, didn't you?
It was
the
bread.
Huh? Okay, yeah, okay. I'm good with it. Do you remember?
Money creation.
You're on the right continent, okay? We haven't gotten to the place where the avatars are yet, but we're, we can hear the awa. Okay. Do you remember? There's one and only one cause of inflation. And see, it's okay because you didn't have me as your econ prof and you haven't had me long enough here to take seriously when I start raging and farting and thundering. So, do you know? It's okay. Okay, here we go. Yeah, go ahead. Talk to me.
The growth of the money supply exceeds the growth of the economy.
Oh, you are so close. It's okay. We'll have dinner together anyway. The growth rate of the money supply exceeds the real growth rate of the economy's need for it. That's the only thing that can create inflation. You're so close, it just makes my teeth hurt. You make my heart warm and my diaper damp. There is no other cause of inflation except when the money supply grows at a rate faster than the growth rate of the economy. You cannot have inflation because some union jacks up its wages. Well, that's inflationary bullshit. You cannot have inflation if some corporation raises its prices. Well, that was inflationary. No, it's not. There's only one thing that can create inflation: if the government prints more money than the economy needs. If the growth rate of the money supply is faster than the growth rate of the economy, you will have an inflation. If the growth rate of the money supply is less than the growth rate of the economy, you will have a deflation. You will probably also have a recession, surprisingly enough. That's the only thing that can create an inflation. Look, if the money supply is held constant, you jack up your price. You just can't afford as much of his stuff or anyone else's. So that drives other prices down, because his went up. So there can't be an inflation just because he raises his price. But if I print money and put it to you, then you can still buy their stuff, buy his stuff, and then inflation has hit. You see, that's how inflation happens. There's no other cause of it. So, yeah, go ahead. Oh, God, that gets into an even worse situation because our trade deficits, our dollars, we are actually literally, when we buy, you buy something from China, our dollars go to China and their stuff comes to us. So literally, you are providing them a dollar, you're trading them a dollar for something, some real asset of they've sold you. So that money sits over there and that becomes part of the money supply. So that as we crank money out and put it into people's pockets to help out our economy here, we have that ocean building over there at the same time. M3. M3 includes euro dollars. That was one of the reasons M3 was skyrocketing in the latter part of the first decade of the 20th century. The Federal Reserve essentially couldn't stop that money from going from building over there. It didn't know how to. It didn't have the guts to go to Congress and say, we got to stop this trade deficit. It's getting out of control. So you had M3 rising at this incredible rate, far in excess of the growth rate of the economy. So how did the Federal Reserve handle that? For one thing, it stopped publishing M3. Now, that'll work. You just stop telling people how bad it is. And for another thing, they clamped down on M1, the kind of money you and I use, cash and deposit, current checking deposits. Well, what do you suppose that does? That creates a deflationary environment for us. We were suffering. We were struggling. Small businesses, regular, normal, everyday people and businesses didn't have money growing at the rate that we needed it to sustain the growth of our economy, and yet M3 was growing like gangbusters. You were creating all of the circumstances for a financial crisis, and surprise, surprise, no one could have possibly imagined, except a guy who calls himself Dark Wraith on the internet, that it was going to happen. Controller of the money supply. The Federal Reserve controls the money supply three ways. The first way that it controls the money supply is through the required reserve ratio, RRR. The required reserve ratio. Now, let me explain to you how the required reserve ratio works. You see, every bank has to keep some of its money that it gets from depositors on deposit. The rest, it just lends out. That's how a bank makes money. But the bank has to keep a certain portion there in the bank so that people can get their money out. Or someone, they can honor checks, or they can honor your ATM card, and all that. So the Federal Reserve sets a required reserve ratio. Now, let me show you how this actually controls the money supply. Suppose that all of a sudden, out of nowhere, a $100 bill floats down and lands on you. Now, will you throw it back out? No, I don't want that. No, you'll take it. Yeah. Okay. So, we have an initial deposit. The M0 that starts this is $100. Now, let's say that the Federal Reserve has set the required reserve ratio at 10%. The bank has to keep $10 of that money. It can lend out the other 90, okay? It can actually lend out the other 90. It's going to take your money, keep $10 in the bank so that if you want $10, you can get it, and then it'll just lend out the rest. So the requirement is $10. The remainder is 90. You go to the bank, madam, and you say, I should like a loan of $90. Why, yes, I have $90 to lend. Ha, ha, ha. So you borrow that $90 and you use it to pay this gentleman to build you a dog kennel so that you can run a dog-sitting business. So he gets the $90 from you, he brings it to my bank and deposits it. Suddenly, I've got a $90 more in the bank on my books. You're saying, no, wait a minute. All you had is 100. I got 190 now. So I take that 90 and I keep 9 of that on reserve for him. And then the remainder, whoops, I put that 90 on. The remainder, which would be $81, is available to lend. You decide that you need a loan. You're going to borrow money. You need $81 to start your own escort service, sir. Sven's Escort and Companionship Service. You take lessons to learn from this lady. She sets up your whole building, your phone bank, and she teaches you how to have a Swedish accent. Hello, my name is Sven. My muscles ripple for you. You say you're 80 years old, that's fine. And you do this, and you pay her the $81 you borrowed from the bank. And so here she comes back, and she deposits the $81 in the bank. Well, I keep $8.10 of it for her, and then I can lend out the rest. What the hell is that? 81 minus 8, 10. 81 minus 8 is 73, $72.90. Now, then I can lend that $72.90 out to someone else. Do you see what's happening? The money supply is expanding. Now, if the reserve ratio had been higher, the expansion would not have been as fast. If the reserve ratio had been smaller, that growth funnel would have been bigger. But in the end, now I could go that and take it down to the penny, but there's actually a formula I can use. The total money supply that is created by just that $100, it's easy enough to do. It will be M0 times 1 divided by RRR. Now, the formula is a little bit more complicated if people keep some money in their pockets and they don't deposit it. There's an extra cash reserve piece. But really, it's this. This is it. So I can say, well, that $100 with a required reserve ratio that the Fed sets would be $100 initial times 1 over 0.10. So that'd be 100 times 10. That $100 created $1,000 worth of new money in the economy. That is a blunt meat axe tool that the Fed has for controlling the money supply. It can move that reserve ratio up, which would slow down the funnel, or it can move that reserve ratio down, which opens up the funnel. Now, does the Fed use this very often? The whole point of the reserve ratio is just to make sure banks have money on deposit. Now, when people are worried about the banking system, we don't want someone to run my bank and I say, I don't have enough money. I don't keep that much money. And then they scream bloody murder and everyone runs to every bank and every bank collapses. So what the Fed does is, this is more when they're worried that the people are concerned about the banking system, you might see them nudge that reserve ratio up some. And then when there's a lot of confidence in the banking system, you might see them nudge it down. And by the way, interestingly enough, it's not just one RRR. There are actually different required reserve ratios for different sizes of banks and for different tranches of deposits. So it's a little bit, and I actually didn't realize how complicated the system was, and it kind of surprises me. Interestingly enough, there are some tranches and bank sizes where the required reserve ratio now is zero. The banks actually don't have a primary reserve ratio. So banks literally don't have a requirement to keep any money for you if you need it. That should worry you, but apparently it doesn't worry the Fed. What I'll do is, on Tuesday, I'll cover the last two, but I will put that video up this weekend for you to watch, and just enjoy it. Watch it while you're eating. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.